This is Circe Olson Wessner, the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeras, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm speaking with military brat, federal lawyer, and author Leslie Susan. She's written a book called Choosing Life, My Father's Journey in Film from Hollywood to Hiroshima. Welcome, Leslie. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I wanted to let our listeners know that we're doing this phone interview, so we'll be dealing with technical glitches like crashing internet or my dog barking at the neighborhood cat, or, you know, things happen, so let's just go with it.
Right.
Yeah. So I wanted to tell you that I just started reading Choosing Life, and it's a pretty amazing story so far. We'll have to get into it a little bit more, but I wanted you to tell our listeners just a little bit about your father and the work he was doing.
So when my father was a young man, he had studied cinematography at the University of Southern California, and at the time, that was about the only place in the world to study cinematography. He got eventually enlisted into the war and was sent to the Pacific Basin, and when the war came to an end, he was ordered as part of the strategic bombing survey to go with a crew to the atomic bombed cities, and they took the only color film footage that exists of the aftermath of the atomic bombings.
Wow.
And seeing the destruction, they had seen bombed out cities, but what shocked my father the most was seeing the human effects, which this was December and January. The bombs had been dropped in August. Elsewhere, people had either died of their injuries from bombing or, you know, might be maimed or injured, but they were healing. In Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he found the hospitals spilling over with people suffering from mysterious scarring and illnesses. He didn't even know what radiation sickness was then. And he was deeply moved by what he saw and felt called to make a record not just of the success of the bomb in causing a physical destruction, but of what the cost of the bomb was in human suffering. After he finished and came back to Tokyo, he was ordered back to Washington, and the film, which had been ordered by the under presidential orders, was suppressed. He wanted to make footage into movies for the American people to be educated about what nuclear weapons were, and persuaded that they should not move forward with these kind of weapons. Instead, the film was buried for decades as top secret. And that combination of the trauma of what he saw and the frustration of not being able to express that, I think, changed him dramatically.
Wow.
When he was in his early 60s, he became ill. And he had a cancer, an unusual form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which he believed, and his doctors could neither prove or disprove, was the late life effect of the time he spent in the atomic bombed cities.
So
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. There was so much that you were saying right there. I wanted to kind of unwrap a little of it. So he was there right after the bombing, like 6 months. So it was still very radioactive. So that would make sense. How long was he in Japan?
He spent about 3 months between the two cities. He had arrived in Japan shortly after the surrender. But they took a train through a number of other cities, and he spent about 3 months first in Nagasaki and then in Hiroshima.
Wow. Did he, when he was, you know, a cinematographer in the military, did he go to, like, Germany or any of the other places and film war footage?
No, he was sent directly to the Pacific, and he was actually on an island just off Okinawa under attack by kamikazes when the war came to an end. So that was pretty much what he had seen of the war, was the Pacific Basin.
Wow. Well, growing up, did your dad talk about the war? Did you know what he did?
I did not. My father did not talk about it. I had the vague idea he had been to Japan and that he loved Japan as a country. And I knew that he had secret pictures up on the top shelf of a closet that we weren't supposed to see, which turned out to be black and white stills from the footage. But I didn't really know until he was sick the story of what had happened to him. And basically, he went to the UN while he was suffering from cancer and being treated. He lived close to the UN, and there was an exhibit there about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he met a man who was exhibiting black and white photographs, and he recognized one of the people in the photographs as someone that he had filmed. And the Japanese exhibitor went back to Japan and fought to get access to the footage, and that started some public awareness of this, and that's when I began to hear the story from him. I didn't really hear him tell me the full story until years after he died, when I discovered a secret oral history that he had left without telling anyone.
Well, you know, that makes me even more intrigued about how you started writing this, the book, because you said that he saw a photograph which at this exhibit, and that intrigued him because he recognized someone. And the same thing happened to you when you were in Japan. You were at a park and you were watching an elderly woman talking to a bunch of school kids, and she holds up a picture of what looked like an American soldier, and when you looked closer, it was a photograph of your dad.
That's correct.
Wow.
Yes, Numata Sensei, with whom my daughter and I later became very close, she actually has known four generations of my family, and she had been a young woman. My father filmed her after she had lost her leg in the atomic bombing, and when the films became available in Japan, after this exhibitor, this group that I mentioned, got access to them, they became accessible there. And she was agreed to speak in a movie they made using footage of her and several other survivors at the time of the bombing from the color footage, and then asking them about what that meant to them. And that experience had convinced her to start. She'd kept her experience secret until then. She decided she owed it to the next generations to share what the bomb had done to her. And she began doing every day in Peace Park, it's called Kataribe, which is a Japanese word for bearing witness, where she would tell her story to groups of school children. And on my first visit to Hiroshima, I went to Peace Park, and I was looking for an opportunity to hear, there are a number of survivors who would do Kataribe, to hear Kataribe, and did not know who she was or that she was someone that my father had filmed. But in the middle of her storytelling, she held up his picture and talked about being filmed, how she found it so painful at the time it was done, and was now so grateful that the films existed to show what had happened, and how its release had completely changed her mind and changed her life. So it was a moment that just, I can't tell you how moving it was to me.
Well, I'm wondering if this book, writing this book, is your variation on bearing witness. Why did you write the book, and who did you write this book for?
Well, the first impetus in this direction was that I tried to get my father to write down his story after I learned it existed. And he insisted that the story needed to be visual. He was a television producer, a filmmaker, and that was his medium. Mm-hmm. And after he died, I knew I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But I am a wordsmith, and it might not be as potent as images, but I believe in the power of words to reach people. So I set out to try to at least take the scraps and notes that he had scribbled down and find out what I could and make a record of the story for, because I thought it was a historical record that needed to be preserved. And the more I worked on it, the more I felt I was writing it for a generation. I mean, it took me 30 years. When I started writing this, I was in my 30s. By the time I finished in my 60s, what my focus was reaching a generation of young people that doesn't remember atomic bombs being used and often doesn't realize the extent of the danger today, but that I believe deeply cares about the planet, and I'm so hopeful about their activism and their energy and optimism. So that's who the book is really for now.
Well, you know, there's so many people that can't even remember World War II. It's not, you know, it's in a history book, but it's not something you can talk to a grandparent anymore about in some instances. So I am thinking that maybe history will be forgotten slowly, you know, and so this is a good thing, because this book isn't compelling. I like that it's a story within a story, so it's bringing somebody, I now know you, and you're in the book, you know, but it's bringing a modern person into, you know, a historic moment and back. You weave these stories together seamlessly, you know, it's like a story within a story, and so it's very gripping. How did you do research for it? I noticed that you've got some of your dad's photos in there, and you know, and you talked about archives.
Yes, I spent time in the National Archives. The footage is now, thanks to the Japanese group, fully available in the National Archives. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to see. At least when I went, they still had to set up projectors, and it's 80,000 plus feet of film, so it's many, many hours of, mm-hmm. of footage. But I did go to watch that. I looked up a lot of military records. The person who wrote the foreword for the book, Greg Mitchell, uh-huh. had been one of the first people to interview my father in the 1980s when he started speaking about the story. And Greg is an investigative journalist, among other things, and he was able to help me get some documents that were difficult to get my hands on. I also went through a lot of our family papers, the photographs I mentioned that were kept in the top of the closet when I was growing up turned out to be a three-volume report of still photographs that he compiled before he left the military. So I was able to use those photographs in the book. And I also talked to survivors while I was living in Japan. I worked with many different people in Japan in the peace movement there, and was able to locate and speak with multiple survivors, many of whom had been filmed by my father, and some other survivors whose stories I felt really brought to life what it was my father had filmed, what he was seeing, and what the long-term consequences were. One of the things that mattered a lot to me is that I think war tends to be seen as a snapshot. Mm. They did this to us, and so we have to do that to them, and that's the way it is. And, you know, somebody loses and somebody wins. And I think, maybe this is having grown up with a filmmaker, but I think it should be seen more like a movie. Mm-hmm. There are so many different things that build up to the point where society breaks down into warfare, and there are so many consequences that flow for decades. You know, we're beginning to understand post-traumatic stress and you know, some of the secondary trauma and what happens to the families of, you know, children of veterans who weren't themselves there are impacted by the effect on veterans. And, you know, people who suffered injury during the war, it's passed down, as with the Holocaust survivors and their children. So that was, I tried to bring together all of those sources, living sources and documentary sources, to tell a full and human story.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, we put together an anthology called War Child, which expresses that exactly. So anybody who contributed a story, they had to have experienced war. And we did get a story from a Nagasaki survivor, a bomb survivor's daughter, talking about her mother. And then we got a story from a Holocaust survivor's child as well. And you, this intergenerational trauma is a real thing, you know. A lot of people don't think about it. I've had people come into the museum and they are talking about their dad or mother's PTSD. And then they start thinking, well, maybe that's affected the way I was raised. That's the way I act and react to things now. And so it's very, very true what you're saying.
I've seen it with survivors and their children in Japan. And I, you know, also know the children of Holocaust survivors. And I know they've been affected. My father was Jewish and we have, you know, roots there too. And I've often wondered to what extent that opened him to see the suffering in a different way. There were many soldiers who were in Nagasaki or Hiroshima during this period, and you know, some of them I think had his kind of reaction, but a great many were very celebratory, which, you know, is understandable because you know, a terrible war was over, they were going to be going home. But, you know, there were people who were picking up souvenirs, posing, including members of the of his own crew. And I've often wondered, you know, whether his knowledge of what had happened in the Holocaust made him look at the whole thing in a different way. I don't know. It's impossible to know, but but I do know that he saw human beings. He was, you know, impressed by, he was just as happy as everyone else that the war was over. I'm not suggesting he wasn't. And, you know, I don't know, I don't think he thought at the time about, oh, they should or shouldn't have dropped a bomb. And one of the things I've tried to avoid in this book is relitigating World War II. You know, that's really, to me, not the useful question now. What he thought from the first day, according to his oral history, was that now that we know that this, I mean, he of course didn't know anything about what atomic bombs were, you know, was very secret then, and, and he was just, you know, more or less of a grunt. But he said, you know, now that I've seen this, clearly we won't want to ever do this again.
So you decided to take up his reins on this thing and go forward and write this book, because it does need to be shared. And it is his story and it's your story. And, you know, this is what makes the human part of a war, not just a textbook thing, you know. So why did you actually go to Japan in person and spend an entire year there? I mean, you took your family.
So my father's last wish, I wasn't there when he passed from the cancer, but my brother was with him, and he said my father's last wish was to have his ashes scattered at Ground Zero in Hiroshima. Yeah, so that's the degree to which this story had become so much a part of him. And so I, at the time, I had a new baby, and my brother and I talked and talked about what to do. And my daughter was very young, as I say. So I felt she was old enough, I finally decided that I was the one that needed to go. And I contacted actually the Japanese embassy and learned that it would be illegal to scatter ashes in Japan. Mm-hmm. Now that I know Japanese culture much better, I understand why, but I didn't at the time.
Right.
They reverence the ashes of ancestors, and the idea of scattering it seems sacrilegious.
Right.
But so I did not bring his ashes, but I held a memorial service for him at Ground Zero. Mm-hmm. And I had an open return ticket. I didn't know I was going to spend a year in Japan. I just took my daughter and, you know, went there, and I wanted to be there for the ceremony, the memorial service on the anniversary of the bombing. And so I held a memorial service with a few friends that I had met in the 2 weeks I had been in Japan. I had, a couple of people I had been in touch with from the peace movement, and a friend that had been I had had a exchange student who had lived with me, and we've been friends ever since. Mm-hmm. So they came, and I had a little memorial service, and I decided that I needed to spread his words and spread his story rather than his ashes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that the only way to do that was for me to understand his story better. And so I decided I needed to stay and try to speak to, if possible, to people that he had filmed, to try to understand what he had seen. And the daughter of someone who died from the atomic bomb eventually offered my daughter and I a place to stay. And my daughter, she was a teacher, and my daughter started going to her classes, and we really fell in love with Hiroshima and became part of the community. And we've been back many times since. We were supposed to be there for the 75th memorial service in 2020, which would like, obviously, the pandemic prevented that.
Right.
But that was my goal, was to have the book published in time for the 75th anniversary and to bring it to my friends in Hiroshima.
Wow. Well, I'm still thinking about, an American with a young child just getting an open-ended ticket and then just staying. I mean, didn't you have things and obligations back in the States that you had to deal with? Or had you kind of sort of in your mind subconsciously maybe put them already behind you before you went to Japan?
Well, what happened was that I had been running a center for abused children in Washington,
mm-hmm.
and the center had been defunded. It ran out of funding,
mm-hmm.
and I had a young daughter, and I participated in something called the Lay Ministry Lab, mm-hmm. which was a 9-month kind of discernment mm-hmm. program to figure out, what are your goals in life,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and it was in the course of that I thought, well, I don't have a job right now. My father had passed away and left a small amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter is not yet in school. If I'm ever going to go to Japan to carry out his wish to have at least a service, I had hoped to take his ashes there.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, this is the time to do it when I... instead of seeing my future as terrifyingly open and not knowing what I'm going to do,
right.
I decided to see it as an opening and an opportunity to do what I felt called to do. So I kind of took a leap of faith. I had enough money from him to buy the round trip tickets, and I rented out my house to a tenant,
mm-hmm.
Just went.
Well, talk about,
went to see what would happen.
Talk about things just aligning. Just, the sun and the moon and the planets all aligning. So I know you talked about this a little bit a couple of questions ago. But again, so what message do you want us to take away from this book?
So this is a story that's unknown in this country. So part of what I want to do is make a historical record of it. That's not true in Japan. In Japan, the story is sufficiently well known that when I stepped off the train in Hiroshima, I was met by television and news reporters and followed around. So, you know, it's widely known there, but it isn't known here. So I'm really speaking to Americans. This is the country that has the most nuclear weapons and is the only country that has used them in warfare as opposed to testing. And so I think, as my father thought, that it's most important for Americans to understand what nuclear weapons really are, what war is, and what nuclear war means for the potential for future life and civilization. And the way I have tried to put it to people that I hope that they'll understand after reading the book is that there are many things that matter in this world, that matter in this life. The pandemic matters and what it's done to people. Black lives matter and what, you know, racial injustice has done to people. Climate change matters and its threat to the ecology of the world. But the truth is, if we don't stop the threat of nuclear war, none of those things will matter because civilization will not exist.
Wow.
So that's my message.
That's your message.
So if you follow the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, the doomsday clock, which they set to reflect how near we are to catastrophe, and basically the end of civilization, the doomsday clock is now 100 seconds from midnight. That's the closest it's ever been in history.
Wow. That is.
So I think there's an urgency that people aren't feeling.
Well, I do know that there is a veterans group out there called Veterans for Peace. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they're they're a national organization. But it is sobering. Every once in a while, you know, it'll pop up on the news. Well, the doomsday clock has moved up 2 seconds, and since it's a hypothetical, you know, I think people just look at it as, oh, it's a hypothetical. But they don't realize that there are people who are looking at algorithms, they're looking at policies, they're looking at, you know, rhetoric, they're looking at actual events, and they're weighing all of these things, and they're saying, this is where we are. You know, it's not crying wolf, it's a reminder that things are gelling. go ahead.
I was just going to say that it's not set by a bunch of activists. It's set by scientists. It's a board of scientists who do closely track and carefully consider every development. I mean, right now we have the United States planning to develop new and improved nuclear weapons. So, you know, we had left every agreement that had fostered it. Now we've returned to one, which is a blessing. I will end on a happier note as far as this, though. There are reasons to believe that we can stop nuclear weapons. The United Nations Treaty for the Complete Elimination of Nuclear Weapons finally entered into effect this month. It was ratified it had to be ratified by 50 countries to take effect. Now been more than 50. So nuclear weapons are now illegal. And that, I think, represents a growing world consensus that they're immoral. It is true that the United States has not joined that treaty, nor have the other nuclear powers. But it still gives me hope that the world is going to eventually turn its back on them.
Well, I think people, once they read your book, will form new and, you know, more fact-based opinions of nuclear, the effects of nuclear war. So the book is called Choosing Life, My Father's Journey in Film from Hollywood to Hiroshima. I know it's available as an ebook on Amazon, other outlets, wherever books are sold, bookbaby.com. It's print on demand from any bookstore that sells books. And do you have a website or other social media? What's your website?
I do, yes. Okay. It's Hiroshima-choosinglife, one word, .com.
.com. I'll put that on the bottom of our podcast notes.
Great.
So we need to wrap this up, but before we do, is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know? I mean, this is a short one. We'll have to do a more in-depth one later, another conversation. But what would you like our listeners to know that I haven't covered?
Well, I think we've covered a lot. I just hope that people will be excited to approach this book without being intimidated by the subject. I want people to know that there's a lot of human interest and a lot of humor. It's not all gloom, doom, and horror. But it's important to know, I think, the realities that we're all going to, you know, need to make choices about. So I hope people won't be afraid to pick it up and join the journey with me and my father.
Well, I definitely will put the information on the bottom of our podcast. So it's been wonderful talking with you today. And so thank you for that.
Thank you.
And so I just wanted to say to our listeners once again, this has been Circe Wessner speaking with author Leslie Susan. And as always, the museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brat Seal and Military Brats Registry. Thanks a lot, Leslie.
Thank you.